Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
Hey, Kirk. Read anything good lately?
No, just some warranty manuals. For... yeah.
You were talking about that in the other episode.
Yeah.
But you weren't reading that to learn reliability engineering. You were just got a new car, so you were reading that.
Right.
What have you done to learn stuff about reliability engineering lately? Because I know you've wrote a book. So reading your own book doesn't count.
Well, I guess to give a little background of how I came about into the field of reliability, I had after I realized that I really didn't know what I was going to do, and I had some engineering courses in electronics and knew a little bit about troubleshooting, worked in a calibration lab, which required repairing equipment, some oscilloscopes and different instrumentation, but mostly just adjusting ensuring calibration and they met some kind of standard. And from there, I went next as a field service engineer. I got this great job working on ion implantation systems, which are, to the uninformed, are very sophisticated molecular guns that shoot at very high energy dopant materials, arsenic, phosphorus, and boron, into silicon to change it from a P or from a
hunk of silicon into a transistor.
Transistor, a PN junction. So that was a new technology back in the early 80s. Let's see, that was, it was about the mid 80s. And then decided that, you know, really to be, after working on equipment and working repairing these systems and setting them up, installing them, which were quite complex because they had high vacuum cryogenic pumps or turbo pumps for high vacuum, high voltage, 200,000 to 400,000 volts DC. Mm-hmm. The arc would hit you before you could get close enough to touch anything. Mm-hmm. So quite dangerous, relatively, and poisonous gas, boron trifluoride, arsenic pentafluoride, and phosphorus, I think pentafluoride. Really dangerous stuff, but fortunately I survived. Still here. Then that followed. I followed that through working at a company called Storage Tech, and at that point I was managing I first managed a group because Storage Tech had hired a man named Dr. Greg Hobbs to teach them how to do a better job at reliability. I'd worked in their thin film head division for magnetic pickups. Because of the high vacuum knowledge I had and high vacuum equipment knowledge, I'd managed a group of technicians. So I had reviewed a lot of, you know, failures of equipment. In fact, that's what our whole crew was doing, was repairing equipment inside the manufacturing facility. Mm-hmm. And then I met Greg Hobbs, and transferring to jobs, they wanted to start an ESS, environmental stress screening group, to help. They didn't halt at that time, even though Greg had just about come up with that term, I think, at about that same time in 1987 or 89 is when I started that. And Greg and I got to work together. It was very – I thought it was great because he had a whole different perspective. He was not a reliability engineer in any formal training. I think he was structural dynamics. He had a PhD in structural dynamics. And he started talking to me about what I thought was made straightforward sense. Is if you want to know what's going to fail in a product, you take it to some failure point and see why those things fail. In other words, break it before the customer can, or find the limitations and mm-hmm. the weaknesses in the product. And that was just so straightforward. I'd never had a certified reliability engineering or any kind of reliability engineering course at all. I was basically experienced in repairing equipment and knew, had a general sense of why things broke. Well, wires were misconnected, or components were reversed, or something like that. Typically, it had nothing to do what later I found out through reliability engineering, formal reliability engineering, was a very statistically based modeling of what were potentially wear out mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. But you guys, so basically you guys started with, you had hands-on experience, right? You
hands-on
did a lot of very practical
right.
stuff dealing mm-hmm. with failures.
And prepared, then, soldered, all
and,
that.
And then essentially a mentor that Greg
mentor
became
that
over time.
Very different viewpoint from the conventional. And in fact, he was definitely a rebel in the world of reliability engineering, coming up with the term of empirical discovery techniques, which we talk about HALT and HAS, which were poor acronyms, but we live with them now.
Well, there's, I mean, and it wasn't just Greg. They were, HP about that time was doing
Strife,
and there was most and multiple environment over stress testing. And there's lots and lots of different ways it's called. And Greg published a book on it and popularized HALT.
I think Greg was a, other than Strife, Greg was one of the first to come up with the idea.
And it was kind of due. We were tired of doing long-term stuff. Product life cycles were getting shorter and shorter for development cycles. We needed answers
right.
faster. So it was the appropriate way to go.
Right.
But now beyond that, though, I know you were involved with the ARS? No, not ARS. AS.
No,
what was the conference?
Accelerated. Okay, yes. In 19, I think it was 1990.
So it was about the time you really got started doing HALT.
Yeah. Oh, right? It was 87. I got invited to speak by Harry McLean, invited me up to come. He had heard my name through the grapevine or somehow that we were doing HALT and HAS at Storage Tech. And I got invited to come to the first ESS-EH, which was Environmental Stress Screening of Electronic Hardware workshop up in, I think it was Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
And there I met a key engineer, Charlie Leonard, who was a very high-level, long veteran of Boeing aircraft. And he had been frustrated for many years about how the orientation had been to cooling, and that he believed that much of the cost of, you know, weight in a 747, for instance, was due to the cooling requirements of electronics because of our belief in the Arrhenius equation being a major factor in reliability of or wear out of electronic hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And there's plenty of articles that show that was no significant large correlation or a strong correlation between those two factors. And as I've talked about, and we've written an article, and in fact, I just got a comment, the drain in the bathtub curve of technological obsolescence really is short, much sooner than the wear out mechanisms of electromigration or
that are temperature driven.
Yeah, temperature driven things, and even hot carrier injection is actually a negative temperature driven. The higher temperature it is, the lower the progression of it. Anyway, I became involved in the committee. It was called at first Accelerated Stress Testing, and it was under, amazingly, we didn't try to join under the Reliability Engineering Society of IEEE. We actually joined and formed it under the what was called the CPMT, which they no longer use.
That's the IEEE packaging division or society.
Yeah, they've changed their name. I'm not sure what it is, but it was Components Packaging Manufacturing Technology at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was somebody, let's see.
Well, we don't need the whole history.
Anyway, you
got involved with that.
So I got involved in that, and we had many annual conferences. Once a year we got together, and it was really meant to talk about discovery testing and empirical
I wanted to compare that, though, to the what you learned and how you learned it in the conference setting and being involved with the committee and selecting papers and presenting and discussions at the conference versus the mentoring from Greg Hobbs or reading a book or other methods. Which would you say has been most influential, and or how are they different? It might be a better way to do it. It's not intended to be an interview, but I wanted to get after how do we really learn this stuff?
Well, it was quite significantly different, I think, from the ways most learn it. And that was, first of all, my practical knowledge of repairing equipment. Second was Greg Hobbs giving me a very strong
But it wasn't a one-time discussion, right? You had an ongoing relationship with him.
Greg and I had 100 lunches together because he didn't like to eat alone. Yeah. So he would seek me out. Yeah. But so we had many, many discussions about this and the statistical. And then I started getting exposed through the ASTR committee and the group what the majority and what traditional reliability engineering had. And so that's where I realized how different my frame of reference was from what had been taught and is still being taught very much in the CRE book of knowledge today and MTBF, statistical distributions, things like that. It just didn't make a lot of sense from my frame of reference of repairing equipment and seeing what the failures were and knowing what the failures are when I worked for a large computer company. It was just always the same that the special cause, the assignable causes were the major reasons that they were having reliability problems. And of course, manufacturing, one of the big ones was when I came into a company, there was a capacitor problem, and it wasn't anything to do with design. It wasn't anything to do with
the manufacturing of the capacitors.
It was mismanufacturing of capacitors, and they didn't know about it. So these are the kind of things I realize makes me feel, and I still believe today, empirical. First of all, you can't. A good design can go bad if you put a bad component over time during the time it's being manufactured. And so a robust design, a design with the most stress capabilities is going to be more reliable inherently than one that is not as capable. Okay.
So Kirk, you're missing what I want to ask about is, well, and this in part comes from a conversation I had recently where it was, well, I'm just getting started in reliability engineering. How do I learn?
And how do you learn?
Right.
Let me put that basic. Okay.
But the way you just outlined this was that it was really a chance meeting with you and Greg Hobbs at that company you were working with and starting to do stress, and that just mapped into your experience really well and reinforced that, oh, this makes sense. This just actually works. And so it becomes a virtuous cycle. You look for more information that supports that area. And then eventually you wrote a book on it. And I'm sure that actually helped you learn it even deeper, right? Even in more nuanced ways and explain it to other people over the years. So
After I left Storage Tech and became a consultant as kind of the next stage I had, I had a client that had a 5% return rate on their product that they'd been shipping for 2 years. And they asked me to come in and help them with that. I tested it. We found a very wide distribution with one particular component exploding.
Bad. And temperature levels. That's usually bad. Yeah, that's usually bad.
And so then I said, let's try the next from 100 watt to 150 watt. Let's try that component.
That'll cost more. It's bigger. We can't do that. We have to redesign it.
Right. So no, I said, no, we're going to go do it. Where's the parts? And I think I actually installed it into the product and then tested it. And we had a 30 degree jump in the average destruct temperature or the limitation. Mm-hmm. Well, immediately within 3 months, they put in a HASS process based on the wider temperature range plus vibration, and they dropped to half a percent.
Yeah.
From 5% to 0.5%. And then they closed the doors and said, well, you can't talk about this to anybody else. Right.
Yeah. And we've talked about that lack of info and sharing. But I mean, the conference is one place people do that. And
yeah,
and
that's where you get the most information, especially in the hallways.
Yeah. And it's the networking. And so to answer that, the overall arc of your experience has been practical, hands-on, your observations and seeing what works and what doesn't work, and those conversations. I'd say Greg Hobbs and Harry McLean and the conference participants and committee members, it's all networking and conversations.
But to tell the engineers today what is the best way, in my view, is what the best way to understand and discover reliability is look into, and it's not easy to do, but to find those failures. If you're in a company that has a log, a history, warranty, whatever, find out why those products failed in the past. That is the fundamental. If you don't know why a product is unreliable, you cannot make a more reliable product. And that's to me the fundamentals of reliability. Don't go to the books. Don't go to the formulas. Don't go to anything. Go directly to the reliability or the warranty returns or the field returns facility, or look at their records and see what the causes of failures are. And that is what reliability is, eliminating those causes of failures. Now, you can't always guard against, we talked about, the capacitor being mismanufactured. And so
you can. There are ways to do it if that's important to you.
Well, you have to be
honest. Costs money. It takes time, but you can do it.
Right. And that's what the HASS is, which I say don't become dependent on just like an inspection process.
Right.
It's good to use in the early part of the manufacturing process, but if you can't fix those things that are continually showing up in a HASS process, then that's a very poor return on investment.
Yep. Yeah. No, it's one of those things is that, I'm going to ask some of the other hosts that we have on the show a similar question. And some of it is, university study and books. And I just as a quick side, and then we'll wrap this one up, is my boss came in to me. I was working in an R&D lab for a series of products. And one of the questions my boss came in with and said, hey, will this new product last 20 years or not? Okay. I have no idea how to do that. And he goes,
people are going to use it for 20 years.
Yeah. They're burying it in concrete, bridges in Italy. And they weren't going to buy it unless we had evidence that would last for 20 years. And I'm like, how do you do that? And so I did, and this is before Google, right? This is, and so I did some library searches and I looked for stuff and I found out about accelerated life testing, and which is, it's how does it fail? It's very similar to what you're talking about, is understand how stuff fails and then you can do something about it. And so I learned a whole lot about accelerated testing, and I ran into at the time, and to this day, I still believe it's the best book out there on accelerated testing, is by Wayne Nelson. And so I ran into a listing in a statistical journal that said, hey, there's going to be an accelerated life test conference in Boston. And I think it ended up being attended by about 40 people. And Wayne Nelson was one of the speakers. So I ended up going and met him, and I was able to got his card, and we traded emails as I learned through his book and through running these tests for the company I'm working with and going forward with that. And so very, very different path, but it was based on a need to make a better product. and to demonstrate in the design that it was a suitable product for its mm-hmm. requirements. But we all get, you know, whatever the path is, we all have different paths and different access to stuff. But I fully believe where you and I have a strong parallel is that mentor, the somebody we could go ask questions of and talk about stuff and right. debate with and stuff like mm-hmm. that. That is gold in my mind.
Right. And I encourage that at conferences, you know, that we discuss the different viewpoints. I mean, and Greg was really good, I think, Greg Hobbs was good at addressing that. And of course, I've now, over 25 years, I've heard pretty much every argument against taking products to operation and struct limits. and the fear that it involves in engineers.
Yeah, but Kirk, if I do this HALT test, what's the MTBF when I'm done?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And Fred, that's another fundamental thing. Right now, especially in technology, we all look at our CD players or our DVRs or, you know, VHS recorders. And the fundamental is that, you know, the life we have, I mean, quantifying, that's what I feel is the bane, has been the bane of not mechanics, but of pure solid state electronics. And that is trying to quantify that life. Because I would argue in almost all cases, even though there's a lot of fear about as we reduce the dimensions of our technology and semiconductors and the densities, that some of those mechanisms may become more short term. But my observation is that we also lower the power on those devices too. So a lot of things are decreasing as far as the forces that cause wear out. That quantification and our focus has been, which was reasonable in the 60s, 70s, maybe 80s, but today's electronics, I'd say, you know, an Apple iPhone, those components are going to last forever except for the battery, okay? Mm-hmm. And I just noticed in the news today that people were replacing, because Apple was offering a low-cost battery replacement, people were replacing, knowing that now, mm-hmm. that they were replacing their batteries because, you know, the technological benefits of each iteration of smartphone is becoming less and less.
Yeah.
You know, and that's Apple is unfortunately feeling the pain of that now.
So Samsung.
Everybody is. You can only do so much.
Yeah, it's not, and that was the whole point of your article. But let's leave that in the show notes.
Okay,
and you should write an update to that.
Maybe I know.
Get some going on that. So for our listeners, I mean, what I want to do in February when this show's being published, and I'm going to write some articles, and Kirk and I would, you know, encourage you to write an article too, is about what's the best way to learn reliability. It came up as a question, and if so, as you as a listener, if you've got a question, what is the best way to learn reliability? And everybody's situation and background are different, so there's obviously going to be different paths for each of us. It is worth learning, though. There are striking similarities, and every time I talk about this subject, it's focus on the failure mechanisms.
Right.
What's causing
right.
the failures? And
what's really causing the failures in the field?
Right.
Real failures. Verified failures, yes.
Right. But it's also talk to your peers, the mentors, the associates, the other people. We all walk around with all this knowledge, and the more we can share and debate, and that advice is really the talk to other people is whatever you want to learn. Is get into a group or get into a team or get into an association that is meant to help facilitate talking about that particular topic. And so there's lots and lots of venues for that. And the conference you mentioned, Kirk, would be an example of that. But let us know, how do you go about learning reliability, and what are your challenges, and what are you looking for? We'd love to hear from you over at ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. So Kirk, you got a last thought here?
No, other than the best way to understand reliability is to find out why things are unreliable. And that's really find out, not theory, not speculation, but look in the records, look in the field returns. And if you can't do that, break it yourself and find out why it breaks.
besides that, it's fun,
simple.
Too.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
All right.
As Adam said, thank you for letting me break your stuff. You know,
that's right. Yeah, he's got a whole thing going now with use case number 7, I think he calls it. I'm interested in see what he breaks coming up. So it'll be interesting. So anyway, thanks so much, Kirk. We'll talk to you later.
Okay. Thank you, Fred. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.